Miss Muttley.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the Ukraine war, the prospect of a nuclear disaster has become a possibility. Kiev and Moscow have once again traded accusations of shelling on the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which was rocked by powerful explosions. Even though the damage to the buildings was not critical, it still shows that the specter of a nuclear catastrophe remains, in addition to a nuclear war. This edition of the Spotlight will discuss the Ukraine war and how the U.S. interest in ending the war is possibly pushed back by Ukrainian officials. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the Spotlight. Marcus Papadopoulos joins us. He's a historian, political analyst, and author. Also joining us, Gilbert Doctorow, an independent international affairs analyst who joins us from Brussels. Welcome to you both. Marcus Papadopoulos, first over to you. We're looking at this Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, of which explosions were reported, 15 of them. And it comes at a time where there was relative calm, as it was reported. What do you think about the timing of this? And, of course, you have each side blaming the other, Russia blaming Ukraine and vice versa. What gains are there for each, and why can't this be verified?
Well, it is, of course, a very troubling and concerning situation at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. The problem is that the Ukrainian armed forces are provided with cover by their patrons, specifically America and Britain. It is not in the interests of the Russian army, who control, let me say that again, control the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, to fire shells at it. Why would the Russians attack an installation which they control? Furthermore, why would the Russians risk a nuclear catastrophe which would only devastate Russian lands and the Russian population? The Ukrainian government, together with its patrons in Washington and in London, are using all means at their disposal to galvanize maximum support amongst people across the world in their war with Russia. Therefore, the Russian army will be accused of everything, no matter how scandalous it is, no matter how utterly ludicrous it is, and most importantly of all, no matter if there is no supporting evidence. And the situation at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant is but one example of that. So there we have it. It's a very dangerous situation there. The Russians have referred the matter to the United Nations Security Council, but alas, the Americans and the British, together with the French, it must be said, are providing cover for the Ukrainian government at the United Nations. So we can say with certainty, the West has no regard, has scant regard for a population being infected by radiation should a catastrophe erupt at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant.
Okay. Well, we have an interesting development here, Gilbert Doctorow, aside from that, and that has to deal with peace talks, where you have a key advisor to Ukraine's president that has rejected, according to the reports, the West proposal for holding talks with Russia. Now, what's interesting about this is the fact that it's the West, and I would guess the U.S., the scenario that's being painted, that is pushing for the talks, and yet you have Ukraine that's rejecting that. Is there a possibility that there's a scenario being set up here, or do you actually think that this is valid and that it's sincere in the way it's been reported?
Sincerity in reporting on the Ukraine-Russia war can be excluded without much close examination. Logic can be excluded from analysis in Western media of what is proceeding, as my colleague just mentioned, describing the nonsense of the allegations that Russia is presently attacking a nuclear power plant, which it otherwise controls. The timing of these events is not fortuitous. They all are linked in a way. The Ukrainians resist the notion of peace talks because they understand that with the start of peace talks, the flow of arms into Ukraine would halt. And it is difficult to imagine that that flow will ever be restarted. Again, looking at the schedule, the incoming United States Congress in January will have in the House a Democratic minority, a Republican majority, and they will be viewing with a very skeptical eye any further appropriations and shipments of weapons to Ukraine. Should there be peace talks going on and a halt in military activity, it is most improbable that any further appropriations to Ukraine would be realized. They know that in Kiev, and that is why they vehemently oppose the start of peace talks. At the same time, the balance between Russian forces and Ukraine forces is widely contested. The Western media, like the regime in Kiev, speak of the wonderful advances of the Ukrainian army against the Russians in retreat, and hold the prospect of even capturing the Crimean Peninsula in the summer. This is all complete rubbish from the standpoint of other observers, myself included. There is reason to believe that the Ukrainian successes around Kharkiv and the capture of the city of Kherson are a flash in the pan. In the case of Kherson, which has been most celebrated recently as a great Ukrainian victory, it has to be pointed out that there are several other considerations that hardly receive exposure in global press, which considerations which would have motivated the Russians to withdraw as they did. The most outstanding one is the position of the city of Kherson as vulnerable to flooding if a major dam, which feeds a hydroelectric power plant in the city of Kakhovka to the north of Kherson, but on the banks of the Dnieper, if that were to be exploded, as was one of the false flag potential operations of Ukraine. If it were exploded, the whole downstream of the Dnieper would be flooded, and in particular the city of Kherson. So the Russians understood this well. The Ukrainians were threatening quietly to blow up that dam, and the Russians moved out to avoid being caught in an inundation. Mm-hmm. It is also not irrelevant that the Ukrainians are now abandoning the city of Kherson, and surely that question of flooding is in their consideration.
Okay, so that clears up the whole notion of Kherson as a major Russian defeat, as it was widely reported, Marcus Papadopoulos. Do you agree with the viewpoint there of how Kherson is not, as I mentioned, a major defeat for the Russians?
That the Russian army had to carry out a tactical retreat from the right bank of the River Dnieper in the Kherson Oblast was a setback, and an agonizing setback, given that Russian soldiers had died capturing it and had died defending it. Nevertheless, it was not a defeat. It's in war, land is won, lost, and then recaptured. And at the same time, what cost did the Ukrainian army pay on the right bank of the River Dnieper in the Kherson Oblast? Well, independent military analysts suggest that in the past few months, approximately 20,000 Ukrainian soldiers perished on the right bank of the River Dnieper in the Kherson Oblast. So that was not a military victory for the Ukrainian army. It was more of a symbolic victory. And at the same time, it was not a defeat for the Russian army. It should also be said that as a result of partial mobilization in Russia, vast amounts of Russian soldiers are gathering in Belarusia, they are gathering in the Donbass, they are gathering in Kherson, they're gathering in Zaporozhye. And it is my contention that we will soon see massive and major offensives in Ukraine by the Russian army. I would not be surprised if we see a three-pronged attack from the Russian army. A first force from Belarusia invading Ukraine from the north and capturing the Ukrainian-Polish border. Then a second Russian force from Belarusia entering again Ukraine from the north and dividing Ukraine in two by capturing the regions of Zhytomyr and Vinnytsia. And thirdly, another Russian armed force invading Ukraine from the north, from Belarusia, with the aim of capturing Kiev. That is something you won't hear Western mainstream media talking about, but that is a distinct possibility.
Well, one of the things that has been said about Kherson, if it's true, and if you agree, I should say, Gilbert Doctorow, is the fact that Vladimir Putin wanted his forces to regroup and to rethink its strategy. Maybe it falls along the lines of what Marcus Papadopoulos just mentioned. Do you think that's the case?
Well, exactly where the Russians will make the next move is anybody's guess. However, the fact is that the mobilized reservists are being in their final stage of preparation to do war. They will be ready in the next few weeks. Also in the next few weeks, towards the New Year's, the ground in Ukraine will be firmed up by frost and will be suitable for tank advances and other mechanized operations on the ground. So these two factors combine to indicate that the Russians will be prepared both in manpower and in physical ability to realize an attack by the new year. We can expect some lively activity then. And the stories about the Ukrainian victories will then be sad history.
There was a major development that happened, Marcus Papadopoulos, and that was about the two missiles that landed in Poland and claimed the lives of two people there. So lots of talk about when it happened. Obviously, Ukraine, and in particular, the President Zelensky came out and said, Russia did this, Article 5 needs to get triggered, etc. And what's interesting about this is the way that the U.S. has reacted, or should I say U.S. and NATO. Do you think that if that was the case, if Russia did indeed, whether on purpose or not, and I'm just speculating or setting up a scenario that hasn't happened, but if it were the case that Russia did do this, do you think that the U.S. and NATO were ready to respond? Or did they opt not to do it because of the way the story developed?
Well, first of all, let me clarify that Article 5 of the NATO Charter does not provide for a missile which enters the airspace of a NATO member unintentionally. That is why, even if the missile which entered Polish airspace had been a Russian one, Article 5 would not have been invoked, because the Americans, who are the de facto chiefs of the Western military bloc, would have known that the missiles fired by the Russians unintentionally. And even if, let's just say hypothetically, the Russians were testing the reactions of the NATO leadership by deliberately firing a missile into Poland, again, Article 5 would not have been invoked. Why? Because America would know that would lead to a conventional war between itself and Russia, which would rapidly escalate into a nuclear war between the two. Let me just say this. The chances of a war between America and Russia are negligible. Why? Because ever since the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis, there have been numerous channels of communication in existence between the political, military, and intelligence elites of America and Russia. And as a result of that, ever since the end of 1962, America and Russia have been able to avert a nuclear war between themselves. Now, that might not be the most tantalizing aspect to the relationship between the two superpowers, but it is the most important aspect to their relationship. The Americans and the Russians will not let anyone or any country incite a war between themselves. And I also believe that whilst Zelensky is a puppet of America's, I suspect there are people within the American corridors of power who are starting to become concerned by him. And it is also distinctly possible that the Americans have lost some control over him, because he clearly attempted to incite a war between NATO and Russia, even before an investigation was carried out to determine the origin of the missile which fell on Polish territory. So again, there will not be a war between America and Russia. I have complete faith in the Americans and the Russians to avert a nuclear war between themselves, because it would mean the destruction of both of their countries.
Sure. Well, this is what's a little bit hazy in terms of the status of arms and personnel. Gilbert Doctorow, we hear on the one hand that Ukraine is running low, and the countries that are supposed to provide Ukraine with military equipment, such as the U.S., and some of the European countries are also running low on that. On the other hand, we hear about personnel that at this point, for example, the EU, signed off on a military assistance mission to train 15,000 Ukrainian personnel in various member states. What do you make of these developments, first of all? Are we looking at this war for these developments to point to the fact that the war is going to be prolonged, that's going to just keep continuing?
There was a lot of posturing going on. The 15,000 troops will be trained for deployment when? After Ukraine ceases to exist as an independent country or is just a rump country. But with your permission, I would like to respond to the very dramatic statements of my fellow panelist that there's no chance of a war, a nuclear war between the two great powers. That is a view with a sell-by date. And a sell-by date is like 20 years ago. The whole fight that's going on now between NATO, driven by the United States, and Russia is over precisely this issue of warning times, which would be reduced from the days of 1962, when it may have been a half an hour or 45 minutes, and lines of communication may have made sense. Lines of communication today between Washington and Moscow have no sense whatsoever if the time between launch and arrival in Moscow or elsewhere in Russia is 5 to 7 minutes. And that is what this war is all about.
The EU has come out and made some statements, Marcus Papadopoulos, regarding not only military spending, which they said increases of up to 200 billion euros for the next few years need to be exercised or spent, but also the EU foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, in a meeting said that the U.S. is not reliable for security. And the notion of this European army, again, was put out there. Does Joseph Borrell have a worry because the Republicans perhaps are coming into control and we don't know who may be president in the next couple of years? And in a general sense, it doesn't want to hand over the security of the European Union to the U.S.? Is that a sign of some cracks there or divisions between the EU and U.S.?
Well, there certainly are divisions in private between Washington and Brussels, despite proclamations by the leadership of the EU to the contrary. The reality is that there are many European governments who do not wish to be part of the European Union's economic crusade against the Russian Federation. And when it comes to Joseph Borrell, we have to remember that the leadership of the European Union are utterly beholden to America. They are in their jobs because of the Americans. They owe their status and their wealth because of the Americans. The Americans exercise enormous influence within the European Union. And that helps to explain why despite grave reservations in Paris and in Berlin about participating in an economic war against Russia, the European Union went ahead and has participated in this war. Though at the same time, and Western media has not covered this, the European Union, on the silent, has started to import coal and timber from Russia again, which, of course, is strictly prohibited by the EU's sanctions. And also, if the European Union was truly democratic, as it purports to be, then why doesn't it ask the ordinary man and the ordinary man and woman across the European Union for their consent to place sanctions on the Russian economy? Because that is the very essence of democracy. If a government, if a government governs in the interests of itself and not in the interests of the ordinary people whom it represents, then it is not a democratic government. It is a tyrannical government. Uh-huh. And I urge people to read the works of John Milton, John Locke, and John Stuart Mill, who very clearly detailed that.
All right. Well, we're trying to understand if we can even talk about a notion of an end game here, Gilbert Doctorow. In terms of the U.S., it seems, again, it seems like there's some ambiguity, unless the notion of ambiguity is something the U.S. wants to portray at this point. But the only real solid, perhaps, posturing at a minimum that took place was from Lloyd Austin, the U.S. military chief, that said, we want to see Russia weakened to the degree that it can't do the kind of things that it has done in invading Ukraine. Do you see an end game from the U.S., and in what form would that be?
I think the end game from the U.S. will be when it slowly, quietly abandons Mr. Zelensky after his armies are smashed and the Russians have taken control of the Black Sea littoral. These are possibilities that may be realized in the next several months. Just as looking for splits within the European Union that hopefully could result in a change of position with a war is a hopeless task, a loser's task, since, as my colleague said, all decisions actually are made in Washington. So in Washington, Washington is the proper place to look for a change in policy. And the Americans will reverse position with the same abruptness, without consulting their allies, the same as they did when they left Afghanistan. So then we will have leaders like Mr. Scholz, like Mr. Macron, holding the bag and looking quite foolish. That is the end game that I see.
All right, and finally, a quick question from you, Marcus Papadopoulos, in less than a minute. What happens with Russia is something that is said is going to happen with China down the road in terms of the way that the U.S. handles this. So how do you think the U.S. is going to handle this in order to pursue its ultimate goal, in a sense, which is obviously what it's doing with China and what it's predicting to do with China at a minimum?
For 30 years, Russia asked, told, warned America not to extend its tentacles to Ukraine. And as a result of the Americans ignoring what the Russians asked of them, told them, warned them, Russia really had no response, but to, no choice but to take military action in Ukraine. The Americans knew that they would give the Russians no choice. And when it comes to Southeast Asia, again, the Americans are giving the Chinese no choice but to take military action in Taiwan. I am against war. I do not like to see anyone dying in war, but I also understand that we have to determine the origin of war. And what
we
see at the moment in Ukraine could very well play out in Taiwan.
Thank you very much for that. Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author. Gilbert Doctorow, thank you. Independent international affairs analyst from Brussels. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitagway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وجنود إبليس أجمعون.
And the soldiers of Iblis all together.
قالوا وهم فيها يختصمون.
They will say while they dispute therein,
تالله إن كنا لفي ضلال مبين.
By Allah, we were indeed in manifest error.
Brothers and sisters, we have reached the 96th verse of this chapter, Surah Ash-Shu'ara. قَالُوا وَهُمْ فِيهَا يَخْتَصِمُونَ تَاللَّهِ إِن كُنَّا لَفِي ضَلَالٍ مُبِينٍ. And they will say, when they are mutually quarreling therein, by Allah, we were certainly in manifest error. Now, what we understand first from these two verses is that contrary to the environment of paradise, which is entirely full of safety and peace, the hell is always full of blame. It is always full of enmity and curse. The curse of the followers to the mischief leaders, and the blame of the sinners unto Satan. The hate of the worshipped deities unto the polytheists, and the act of quitting the criminals from each other. Now, the Holy Quran is replete with these verses discussing these aspects, including these holy verses of the Holy Quran, which illustrate the scene of the conflict and the quarrel of those that are therein. When they are in the hell, they quarrel both with their deities and with each other. So the verse says, قَالُوا وَهُمْ فِيهَا يَخْتَصِمُونَ. They will say, when they are mutually quarreling therein. The word يختصمون comes from خصم, which means enemy. And this خصم, an enmity, has its origins in the false loves and likes of this world. This is what originates the fight of hereafter, even in the fire of hell, quarreling with each other. So this quarreling, this fight between the enemies of Allah still continues unto that world and in the fire of hell, which means they will not stop even there. قَالُوا وَهُمْ فِيهَا يَخْتَصِمُونَ. They will say when they are mutually quarreling therein, and yes, these misguided worshippers will say, تَاللَّهِ إِن كُنَّا لَفِي ضَلَالٍ مُبِينٍ. By Allah, we were certainly in manifest error. They believe. They confess to their own problems and sins. And their inner selves will be awakened on that day.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qum.
So the verses say, قَالُوا وَهُمْ فِيهَا يَخْتَصِمُونَ تَاللَّهِ إِن كُنَّا لَفِي ضَلَالٍ مُبِينٍ. They will say, when they are mutually quarreling, by Allah, we were certainly in manifest error. So this is the time that these enemies of Allah, these polytheists, these worshippers of false idols, they will believe and they will truly understand and recognize that they were in manifest error. The word dhalal means something which is totally away from the truth. And this manifest error means something that either it is manifest right now or something which was manifest in the other world, in the world, I mean, but we were not truly recognizing that because we were not looking at the things that the vicegerents of the Almighty Allah told us. We were not listening to how the prophets invited us. So although this was dalalin mubin, this was manifest error, but we could not have understood that because we were not listening or we did not want to listen. This is what the false idols do to human beings. This is what living without logic does to human beings. You may remember they said, بَلْ وَجَدْنَا أَبَاءَنَا كَذَلِكَ يَفْعَلُونَ. They said, we found our fathers so doing, so we continue what they started. This is what happens, that they will understand they were in manifest error, dalalin mubin. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
In the 2020 presidential election campaign, Joe Biden made a full return to the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program, a key plank of his foreign policy promises. After 2 years in office, his report card on keeping that promise can only be given a failing grade. Not only has Biden not returned to the JCPOA, but he has constantly levied new sanctions on Iran and seems to have fully retained the maximum pressure policy of his predecessor.
For 2 years now, Biden and, you know, his team of foreign policy ghouls like Tony Blinken have refused to lift the illegal sanctions dating back to the Trump era. You know, Trump illegally withdrew from the JCPOA, and they're refusing to lift those sanctions, which has made any negotiations with Iran impossible.
Biden had benefited from total control over Congress, but the Democratic Party lost control of the House of Representatives in the recent midterm elections. Low turnout and disillusionment with many unkept promises are often being cited as the main reasons for the Democrats' defeat. Last month, a top poll on foreign policy found that a whopping 79% of Americans want the United States to continue to pursue negotiations with Iran. On almost no other key foreign policy question was there such massive support. With Congress now divided and more conservative, most analysts say that even if Biden did genuinely pursue diplomacy, Congress would easily block the deal under the so-called Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act.
You know, the ball has been in the U.S.'s court for 2 years, and, you know, I can see no reason to believe that Biden or the U.S. is committed to the agreement or negotiating in good faith. All they've done is ask for more concessions from Iran. And actually, more recently, they seem a lot more interested in trying to destabilize the country by meddling in its affairs, its sovereign affairs, of course, referring to the recent protests.
With their recent accession to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Iran has significantly expanded their diplomatic cooperation with their non-Western allies. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
An incident that caused Iranians a great deal of agony. Iranian mourners took part in the funeral procession of the victims of the terror attack in the city of Izeh in floods of tears. In addition to expressing their deepest sympathy with families of the victims, the participants also voiced their support for the Islamic Republic amid the enemy's efforts to destabilize the country.
We have taken part in this funeral procession to send a message to the U.S. and Israel. They must know that Iran is not alone. We support the leader of the Islamic Republic and the Iranian nation. They cannot sow division in Iran by killing civilians. We will be victorious.
My fellow countrymen and dear people of Izeh, be sure that the Islamic Republic is strong and will definitely take revenge for the blood that has been shed by all the cruel enemies who are servants of the criminal government of the United States.
Also, a number of high-ranking state and military officials attended the funeral, vowing to bring the perpetrators of this crime to justice as soon as possible.
The perpetrators of this crime will be punished. A number of them have been arrested, while some others have been identified. Some of them attempted to flee the country through border crossings. However, they have been arrested. We will inform the Iranian nation about arresting the rest of the perpetrators in the coming days.
Officials say so far 11 individuals who've been involved in Izeh terrorist attack have been detained. Seven people, including a 9-year-old child and a woman, were killed, while 11 others were wounded after gunmen started shooting at people in the center of the city.
The terrorist attack was completely pre-planned. The terrorists broke the cameras across the city by shooting at them 24 hours prior to the attack. Then the next day, they opened fire at people at a crossroad from two directions. Their goal was to cause a massive bloodshed.
As they said, the enemies cannot turn Iran to another Syria or Lebanon by carrying out violent acts like the ones in Shahcharagh, Isfahan, and Izeh.
Iranian officials have strongly condemned the recent terror attacks in the country. They say the enemies of the Islamic Republic have now resorted to armed terror attacks that target civilians because they have failed to advance their anti-Iran agenda through creating media hype. Mahdi Abbasian, Izeh, Khuzestan.
The trailer released on Thursday for the documentary movie From Tehran to Tirana is so powerful in its message about the MKO and its practices that it leaves no room for doubting why every defector that has managed to flee insists on calling it a cult where members are required to demonstrate complete devotion to its leader.
Ever since I joined the MKO in Iraq and I realized that they had lied about everything, I wanted to leave, but it was almost impossible. Finally, when we were relocated to Albania, I found the opportunity to escape. Many inside the camp are not as lucky as me.
The movie is inspired by a book of the same name written by a defector who managed to escape the camp 2 decades ago and who has dedicated his life to raising public awareness about the MKO.
Najat NGO was founded by a number of defectors about 15 years ago.
Our mission is to reunite families with their loved ones and help defectors escape. We also try to raise awareness about this cult and how they recruit people.
Leaving the camp is almost impossible. I was recruited when I was a prisoner of war in Iraq. I was told that they would help me go home. I later found out that Saddam had allowed this. And also I met members who had come to Camp Ashraf with false promises of employment or asylum in Western countries and brought into Iraq illegally. We were all asked to submit our passports and ID cards, which effectively trapped us there.
The movie also highlights the new methods of recruitment through social media platforms by the MKO's so-called keyboard warriors, a group of about 300 MKO members who run fake social media accounts.
Parents should be very careful. They are now using new methods to recruit the younger generation. They ask these young people to go out on the streets and take part in riots and send them pictures and videos.
This is not the first time the MKO is using social media to advance its agenda. Previous reports by other TV channels has also revealed their strategy.
Should comment by the different account and not MKO members, Mujahideen, because we want to show the Iranian people support Maryam Rajavi.
So you were a troll?
Yes.
You were an internet troll?
Yes.
The Mujahideen Khalq Organization, or the MKO, is a known terrorist organization. It has killed more than 17,000 Iranians over the past 43 years, and now it is actively involved in riots in Iran by instigating the younger generation through social media to carry out acts of vandalism. The best way to counter this terrorist organization is to raise public awareness, and this is the main focus of the movie. Kisum Shah Ahmadi, Tehran.
Transfixed, ordinary Britons stand glued to their screens, waiting for the news to sink in. After weeks of will he not, the UK's new chancellor has announced his economic plan for the country. Except for a couple of surprise rabbits out of the hat, such as a bit of more spending in the health and education sectors, it was what everyone had expected. Tax hikes and spending cuts aimed at plugging a nearly $65 billion hole in public finances created by the previous Conservative government only 2 months ago. Pretty soon, millions of Britons will be paying more taxes. A freeze on the non-taxable part of their income will mean millions will be dragged into higher tax brackets, and the cap on energy bills introduced by the previous government will be scaled back as of April next year. As if that wasn't enough, Britons are going to see public sector spending cuts to the tune of $30 billion. All this as the country grapples with double-digit inflation, rising energy costs, and a prolonged recession, none of which was lost on the opposition.
What does this mean? Family holidays cancelled.
Yeah.
Savings depleted.
Yeah.
Hopes for the future replaced by sleepless nights.
Yeah.
And all of this on top of the fact that the average worker is earning less today than when the Tories came to power 12 years ago. The government has presided over the biggest wage squeeze in centuries. This was a crisis made in Downing Street, and it is ordinary working people who are paying the price.
As ever, the Chancellor, as did the PM before him, blamed Britain's economic woes on the pandemic and external factors such as the war in Ukraine. But many experts say that's not all.
There are international factors. However, Britain has managed to achieve something on its own for one or two areas, such as the impact of Brexit. Whereas when they were in the EU, they had access to the world's largest free trade area. Britain deliberately took itself out of that and hasn't been able to replace it with anything. So that's had extra costs to it. And so there's also been less confidence in Britain because it's outside that. Why should I be investing? And so if it's not seen to be as really secure and full of confidence, then investors will go elsewhere. And that's what we've been seeing.
Despite the government saying its measures announced today are necessary for balancing the books, there is no doubt that they will have real consequences for millions of Britons for years to come. Saipur is up, London.
The Taliban's Ministry of Vice and Virtue have banned Afghan women from visiting all parks, using gyms and public baths. Recently, women are banned from going to parks, sports clubs, and public baths by the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. For the past 15 months, the orders given to these places were violated and ignored. That's why now it is decided that they should be banned. It is not clear how long the restrictions would last or whether they are going to be lifted.
The famous city park in Kabul, once filled with families' joy and laughter, now has turned idle and silent, with only a handful of men wandering through the complex. The ban order has also affected the livelihoods of people who have been making ends meet by working at public places.
They are interrupting our livelihoods with their decisions. Now they have banned women, so less customers are visiting here. Look, it's in the middle of the day, but no visitors. I have rented a photography shop here, and I used to have an adequate income. But now the ban is making me close it down.
Women rights activists urge the Taliban to reverse its course on all women's rights, saying such decisions would provoke national outrage.
Instead of attempting to ban the doors of parks for women, the Taliban should manage to let Afghan boys and girls learn. They should address the economic and humanitarian crisis in the country rather than focusing on weird restrictions on women. I'm sure such decisions expose the reality of the Taliban and would face public anger.
The Taliban have already banned women from traveling without a male relative. Secondary schools for girls have also been shut for over a year across the country. Afghan women are worried about being barred from public places after the authorities announced the new restrictions. The women are now calling for justice, demanding the authorities protect their rights. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In Shah-e-Dharab, a week-long exhibition in Indian-administered Kashmir is displaying dozens of rare manuscripts written by prominent poet Khwaja Muhammad Amin Dharab. The language was once officially used in courts and commerce until 1889. The organizers say the aim of the event is to revive Persian language in the region. About 73 manuscripts, including a dozen books written by Dharab, are on display.
Persian is so deeply entrenched that you can't think of a craft without Persian. You can't think of Kashmiri language, forget about Persian, without Persian language. You can't think of our basic ethical and sacred knowledge without Persian.
Persian is what Kashmir is all about. And it still has a resonance in contemporary Kashmiri society. If you go to any urs or any major shrine of Kashmir, the manqabat and the naats that are recited will be jami, they will be in Persian.
Chronogram on Neil Armstrong's landing on the moon, Maharaja of Kashmir's accession to the throne in 1923, elegies of prominent scholars, including on the death of Muslim scholar and jurist Maulana Anwar Shah Kashmiri, are being displayed in the exhibition. The Arab was instrumental in transmitting traditional Persian literature in the region. He is also known as a master of Kitah Tariq and Naats in the praise of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Dharab died in 1979 in Srinagar, but his memories and writings continue to enlighten hearts and minds in the region. The remnants of Persian verses are widely recited in mosques, shrines, Sufi, and spiritual gatherings. The Persian language reached its peak in Kashmir during the Mughal rule, but faded with the course of time. The exhibition organizers say events like this are an ideal platform to revive Persian language and literature.
I want people to know what he has written, because if you keep it in boxes, nobody would know. Maybe the language is not here anymore, but the language never dies. See, even now some people are so interested in it, that's why we are getting a good response. And there is so much of culture in this language, there is so much of history about Kashmir as well in the language, because it's somehow connected with Iran.
Organizers say Dharab's contribution to Persian literature in the valley is also highlighted in documentation of the greatest poets, Ghani Kashmiri. Munawar Zaman, Indian-administered Kashmir.
A resolution was recently presented to the UN General Assembly for the first time after the Taliban took over Afghanistan. While discussing issues including security, terrorism, and the social and economic situation, the Assembly significantly refrained to recognize the Taliban as a government. Experts believe this could affect the nation.
Non-recognition of the Taliban by the global community could negatively affect Afghanistan. It would bring illegitimacy to the Taliban government. It would also have consequences for the country's diplomatic relations, trade, and culture. There may even be more sanctions. These could have adverse effects on people, especially the poor.
In response to this resolution, Suhail Shaheen, the head of the political office of the Islamic Emirate in Qatar, said according to Islamic principles and values, the Taliban are committed to fulfilling all the legitimate rights and demands of the people, and that they are trying to provide the right means and environment to achieve this goal. Experts say the recognition of the Taliban could have positive results.
If the Taliban government is recognized after the observation of human rights and some other standards by the Taliban, it could have very good results for the nation, such as in the fields of international relations and international economic interactions.
Since the Taliban took control 15 months ago, their non-recognition, along with the sanctions imposed on the central bank and the freezing of Afghan assets, has driven the economy of the country to the brink of collapse. It is believed the recognition of Taliban may be a way to improve the situation in the country, but on the other hand, releasing assets and removing sanctions could also be effective. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
In the limelight.
Experts say the United States remains the number one arms exporting nation on the planet. This country actually likes tension in the world because it feeds on the tension by stoking tension between countries and regions around the world and selling arms to the conflicting sides. The U.S. regime fills the pockets of military-industrial complex. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Truthout had an eye on this issue, writing, "Here's a seldom commented upon reality of this century and this moment. The United States remains the number one arms exporting nation on the planet. Between 2017 and 2021, it grabbed 39% of the total global weapons market, and there is nothing new about that. It has, in fact, been the top arms dealer in every year, but one for the past three decades. And it's a remarkably lucrative business, earning American weapons makers tens of billions of dollars annually. It would be one thing if it were simply a matter of money raked in by the industrial half of the military-industrial complex. Unfortunately, in these years, U.S.-supplied weaponry has also fueled conflicts, enabled human rights violations, helped destabilize not just individual countries but whole regions, and made it significantly easier for repressive regimes to commit war crimes."